Welcome to the second hour of Shattering Mist. Before I conclude my comments on the shroud and was Jesus sexy, I know at least that I still have a conscience because it screams at me when I hear grotesquely immoral news. The last item of the news was that General Sinclair, the man that had a forced sexual relationship with a subordinate for many years, the man who used his military credit card to go off and take trips to visit his mistress, the man who threatened to kill his victim and to murder her family if she spoke out about his sexual abuse, was simply reprimanded and had $20,000 in his salary deducted. This is a crime. I have long said that America's military was counterproductive, that we would be vastly safer, richer, freer as a nation if we did not have our military. And there are those who would say, all right, you make a case that that America's military has not been deployed to fight for the freedom of Americans in many, many decades. But, you know, maybe it's not those who volunteer for the military's fault, but instead it might be just the politicians' fault who deploy them inappropriately. But I want to tell you that the U.S. military is extraordinarily abusive. It is the place where women, at least in free societies, are the most vulnerable to being sexually abused. It is the place where not only are they the most likely to be raped, but they're most likely to be abused by those coddling the rapist. It is the place where the rapist is least likely to be prosecuted. And this exercise in military jurisprudence is yet another example that we have a serious problem. And the problem is the U.S. military. It is revolting that this man got off the hook in this way. I'm appalled. Glenn, you have an opinion?
Yes. Let me get in my... I was off on the Bluetooth when I speak. Yeah, it is very, very horrific. I mean, and they gloss over this sort of stuff, you know, with true heinous moral implications, you know, and yet they'll, you know, they'll swat somebody, you know, they'll attack somebody, but like they'll swat this guy on the wrist and they'll turn around and crucify somebody for something minor if he's in the, you know, not high up in the economy.
Well, let me give you a great example. The Abu Ghraib defendants. It was the Secretary of the Attorney General under George Bush that came up with the waterboarding and torture scheme for the inmates at Abu Ghraib prison in Iraq. And the Attorney General, working with the CIA, sent directions as to how these detainees in Abu Ghraib in Iraq were to be treated so as to elicit confessions from them. Then those who followed their orders, who did as they were told to do by the highest ranking American politicians, were then thrown in prison. While those who had orchestrated this scheme and ordered it were left free. I've covered a number of times on this program the astonishing number of American veterans coming home from Iraq and Afghanistan who are taking their lives. That the number is north of 200,000, probably in a range of 250,000. A very significant number of those are women who have been raped. And where the rape was devastating, it's the way they were treated by the military after they were raped that was the most debilitating of all, and they've committed suicide as a result. We have a real serious problem.
This is why I have such a problem with America copying such a parental attitude towards Russia or the rest of the world when it's so blatantly hypocritical, you know, and this reminds me of a couple of things. But lies, violence, and hypocrisy are the order of the day.
Yes.
You know, and hypocrisy, by the way, etymologically, hypocrites, insufficient judgment. You're not sufficiently judging yourself. You know, hypocrisy, hypo, as in,
yes,
you know, hypodermic or hypoglycemia or whatever, under,
yes,
insufficient, and crites, judgment. You're not judging yourself sufficiently.
Right.
But anyway, speaking of hypocrisy, or picking on, one of the things I wanted to bring up before I forget is about the Ukraine. You know, certainly I wouldn't condone their anti-Semitism. I saw a guy, a farmer, being interviewed and filmed, and that guy looked like he was working pretty hard. But and one thing I was going to say in Ukraine's favor is,
yeah,
they didn't have the unfair advantage of a Bretton Woods agreement that let them skim the till of every oil transaction in the world after World War II, as America did. So, I mean, we've been, you know, fleecing the system through the Bretton Woods and the petrodollar and stuff, you know, since World War II. They didn't quite have that source of income.
No, they didn't, but they had an extraordinarily rich country in terms of resources,
right,
and they have managed to do a horrible job of deriving a viable economy from those resources. And while I'm sure there are some Ukrainians that work, those that led the revolution aren't working, and they haven't worked for a very long time.
Right. That's not good. And the IMF knows this. And those physical,
yes,
real-world commodities and agrarian resources are still there, and it's precisely,
yes,
those which they wish to take in exchange for eternal debt service and,
yes,
monopoly money.
Yeah. One of the real problems there is that the Ukraine is dependent on Russian imported, which Russia subsidized for the Ukraine, but no longer will do so. And also that it is a rich farming region, but the product they're producing is no longer edible by humans. I mean, it's animal fodder
now. Same as the U.S. with GMO. Thank you, Monsanto.
well, ours is consumed by humans, whether or not it should be or not is another question.
Exactly.
Yeah, you know, I want to return to the shroud because I do think it's interesting.
I'll wait.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
If you go to, I think it's just shroud.com, and I don't want to endorse anything that is written at shroud, shroud.com. But if you go to shroud.com, about a third of the way down on the, on their homepage, you will see a facial imprint of the shroud of Turin. And you see on the left, it's the irradiated image, and on the right is it's a photographic negative that is imprinted on the shroud, and then on the right, what that image would look like, and you see a very normal looking Jewish man. Reasonably long hair, not terribly long hair, chin length hair, not shoulder length hair, a slightish beard, not a flowing beard, but a trimmed mustache and beard. And while the body that is irradiated onto the shroud is absolutely average, the man was 5'10". Approximately 175 pounds. So, you look at the face. The nose has got a bit of a bump in it. It's not. The cheeks are a little high. The forehead's a little short. This is not. This fellow does not look like somebody who would get a modeling job. And no, he is not Brad Pitt. And so the actual image fits the description of the eyewitness account in Yasha Yah. So that's one of the things in his favor. But what is also interesting, of course, is that there are four eyewitness accounts of Yosha's physical appearance after his fulfillment of Bukhurim, after Pesach, Matzah, and Bukhurim in 33 CE. You've listened to the program. Yeah, there you go. And all four, they didn't recognize him. So he no longer looks like this image. His physical manifestation.
The only description we have in Revelation is his eyes is a flame of fire and feet is burnished bronze and hair, you know, right. All that sort of stuff.
Right. And the description there describes manifestations of light. In other words, when he is in heaven and we're dealing with the spiritual realm, he appears like light. And when he is...
What color is his hair?
Oh, I don't know what color is this white. in this
white.
Image. Okay, white. Yeah, okay, white. Here. And what color is pure light? White.
Right.
So, it's makes perfect sense that this is what he could have looked like. It's not majestic. It's certainly not a Portuguese model's look, and that. The reason that he did not have a majestic appearance, the reason that he was not considered sexy, is because he wasn't here to sell sex appeal. He wasn't here to draw attention to himself. He wasn't here to have people say, you know, I think we need to turn this man into God. I think we need to create a religion based upon the way this man looks. That wasn't the purpose at all. The purpose was to reveal Yahweh's word, his Torah,
right.
And to honor Yahweh's promises relative to the covenant. That was why he was here. And if you look at his appearance and you start worshiping him under a false name and under a sexy appearance, you've lost it. The history
well, right. And this is why
it.
I've never hung my hat on the shroud, pun intended, I guess.
Yeah.
The shroud, you no doubt familiar with some of the discrepancies surrounding that, the discrepancies in carbon dating issues and
allegations of
it being someone like Jacques de Molay and things like that.
Yeah, you know, I've read several books on the shroud. By the way, I'm not endorsing the shroud. I'm just telling you, I found it fascinating because the shroud itself does depict a human body after crucifixion. It exposes the elongated limbs and disjointed limbs that would occur as a result of crucifixion, and it does show not only the after effects of a crown of thorns, but of also of a brutal whipping on the upper body as a result of the Roman flagellum. So there is a lot to it that helps explain the kind of death that Yosha experienced in his physical body. And so I studied it for that reason, and we'll talk a little bit more about it when we return after the break. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. As we just conclude our thoughts on the shroud, the reason I am concerned about the shroud, Glenn, is that the last thing Yahweh wants is for us to view him as a man. And so if we look at the face in that shroud and identify with that face and say that face is the face of God, we are off in a wrong direction. So I'm concerned about the shroud because I don't want myself or anyone to look at a face and say that face represents God. As it relates to the carbon testing that has been done, I did study that for a while. I haven't in the last 5 years, but there was a period of time, maybe for 10 years, where I did read a number of articles on it. And what I came to conclude, at least based on the articles that I had read, is that there were two factors that could have initially thrown off the carbon 14 dating. One is that they took their clippings from a portion of the shroud that looks like it had been added at a later time. It's not a portion where the image appears. It's not even part of the original linen, but
a
part that a border that had been added to provide some structure. Yeah, after a fire. And the second is after a fire, which adds carbon, which would create a false impression. The thing that that spoke in favor of the dating was the pollen analysis that was taken from the shroud. You know, in the Hebrew custom, the body wrapped in the shroud was covered with flowers. things that had a positive aroma because of the stench. Yeah, the stench of death. And so what they did is they were able to trace the pollen to vegetation that they have found in other places has grew in the area around Jerusalem circa 33 CE. And in many cases, those particular plants and that particular strain of pollen is no longer there. And so there was a pretty adept case made on behalf of the pollens. But all of that said, I think the shroud has value for three purposes and no value beyond that. One is that it does depict the effect of crucifixion that is consistent with what is presented in Psalm 22 and 88 that depict crucifixion before crucifixion was even known as a form of death. And so that part of it is interesting. The second is the just the common nature of the individual there that personifies the depiction in Yashaya that his appearance would not appeal to anyone, that there wasn't majesty in the physical appearance, because that underscores the whole purpose. You know, God was not trying to create a religion based on a man. He was trying to reveal his Torah teaching to us in a corporeal way that was tangible, that also enabled him to fulfill the promises, to honor the promises he had made to his covenant's children.
Right. And as I'm sure you're aware, Martin Luther at the time of the Reformation is often quoted as saying something to the effect that there were enough pieces of the true cross of Christ floating around to crucify half the Roman Empire. So it's rather ironic that the Catholic Church should actually be in possession of an actual artifact.
You know, yeah, they are so disingenuous. They're so wrong on virtually everything, and almost all of their physical artifacts are fraudulent and actually idolatrous. And even, you know, you look at St. Peter's in the Vatican. The statue of St. Peter is strictly it's a statue of Jupiter. That was recreated, re-sculpted just a touch to turn the Roman god into the disciple. So the obelisk in the middle of the Vatican. So.
Just like the Statue of Liberty is ISIS, you know, a little tweak here, right. A little change of story there, and you got
yeah.
it, you know.
Yeah, she's Athena, which, you know, is ISIS, and which is Semiramis, which is Astarte, which is the Mother of God, the Queen of Heaven. Absolutely. It would be surprising that Roman Catholicism has one thing right, but even in this, they have everything else wrong, because they have a crucified image of Jesus nailed to a cross in every one of their cathedrals and in all of their churches, and this depiction of God still hanging on a pagan cross, wrongly depicted, is the essence of the lie of the Christian religion. I'm going to return to the prophecy in Yashaya 17. In the first four statements leading to where we are going to pick up the prophecy, God has spoken of the demise of Damascus, that it being nothing but a pile of twisted rubble, of the fall of the Syrian regime, of roaming bands of terrorists acting more like animals than humans, and of collateral damage amongst the refugees, the outcasts in Lebanon and in Jordan, and that how all of this would ultimately lead to the conclusion of the Syrian war, which doesn't conclude with a victor, but instead with in a complete disaster for everyone. The jihadists continue to be terrorists and compel the world to appease them by sacrificing Israel, which takes place as the Syrian war concludes. And the Syrian war, by the way, concludes only because there's no one left to kill. It's not because one side has achieved success over the other. And immediately after Yahweh describes the thinning of Israel at the waist, making the country no longer viable, which is the plan that America is currently articulating and is compelling Israel to accept. God speaks of a harvest. He speaks of calling his covenant children home. And so this is extraordinarily telling. It means that the events that precede the tribulation, this time of great vexing trouble, and the harvest of God's children, and the final treaty that thins Israel at the waist, and the Syrian war are all tied together. That these events all happen in succession. So, fall of Damascus, fall of Syria, roaming bands of terrorists with no one left to kill, collateral damage among the refugees in Lebanon and Jordan, followed by the divestiture of forced divestiture of land in Israel for promises of peace. Leads in that day, at this time, in quick succession, to the harvest of saved souls. This harvest is a secondary harvest. He's speaking of Teruah. It is the second harvest depicted in Yah's testimony, the first being Bokotam, which is first fruits, firstborn children. It has already been fulfilled. The next harvest to be fulfilled is Teruah. This is the testimony that God provides for us. And it shall be like gathering in and receiving of a harvest of standing grain. And with his sacrificial lamb, with his strong arm and power, collecting and harvesting the first fruits. And it shall be as a gleaning, as a smaller secondary harvest of ears of grain in the valley of Rephaim. Now, yesterday we made our way through much of this, that Yahweh uses the metaphor of standing grain to describe his children. They're standing. They're not bent over. They're not bowing down. They're not prostrate. They're not religious. They're standing. They're engaged. They're walking. They're moving as the wind blows the grain. They're moving with God. Kama, which is the word for standing grain, is based on kum. You know, you've heard the campfire song, Kumbaya, means stand with Yah. And this harvest is not just a reaping in of the grain, which is always a symbol of God's children, because the grain is that which is valuable, and the chaff is that which is blown away and ultimately is destroyed. But it's preceded by a kaf, which is a gathering and a receiving, a bringing together, a collecting, an assembling, and withdrawing of the harvest. So this is a harvest of saved souls who are being brought together as family and then withdrawn from the valley of death and taken to heaven. And the means to do this is going to be Yahweh's strong arm, his sacrificial lamb, his Zeruah, the one who shoulders our burdens. It is from Zeruah, is from Zara, which means to sow seeds which produce offspring. And it's from Zara, which is to make known through a diminished manifestation. Zara, to appear, becoming visible light. Now, we talked also about why this is this harvest is a gleaning, a secondary harvest. It is of first fruits, but first fruits here is not firstborn children, Bokotam, but Shibolim. So it speaks of the head of the grain, the most precious part of the barley. And it is a gleaning secondary harvest, a lakot, of this head of the grain, of the valued part of the barley, in the valley of Rephaim, which are souls of the deceased. The earth is going to become a killing field. And that is what the prophecy portends, that man is going to devastate his fellow man. That the kind of savagery that we have witnessed in Syria, where upwards of 200,000 people have been killed, that hundreds of thousands is going to turn to millions, and millions is going to become billions. The earth is going to become the valley of death. And it is from this, from death, that God's covenant children are going to be gleaned, going to be brought together and brought home. Now, while politicians and statesmen are making the planet more dangerous by capitulating to Islamic terrorism, tearing Israel apart in the process, Yahweh will come to gather in and receive his covenant children, sparing them from the wrath of war that is about to besiege the rest of the world. God and his creation will remain at cross purposes during this time. They will be working separate agendas. But there's always a few, the one in a million, who are guided by the architect of life. The comma, the standing grain, the shibboleth, the first fruits, references. They all point to the teruah harvest, when Yahweh will remove his family so that they do not have to endure the tribulation, the earth becoming the valley of death. It is what we would expect from a loving father. Shibboleth, which was translated ears of grain, in association with the secondary harvest, provides an illustration to the primary harvest and to the timing of the first three mikre, Pesach, Matzah, and Bukurim, each of which occurs, according to the Torah, during Abib, the Hebrew word which describes the time when young barley ears are still green and growing in the head of the grain, and therefore a time when God's children are still receptive to his invitations. It comes before the grain is mature, hardened, and readily crushed. In this regard, comma is revealing because it is based, as I have shared, on one of the most important words in all of Yahweh's Hebrew text, kum. It confirms that the sacrificial lamb of God, who stood up for those of us who are willing to stand with him, is going to take a stand once more. And he's going to come for us to bring us home. He's going to honor his promise. We are the standing grain, represented by the two letters which are repeated in Yahweh's name. If you're familiar with the Paleo-Hebrew script that Yahweh used to etch his name in stone on the two tablets, you'll see that his strong arm, his Zeruah, is depicted in the first letter of his name. It is an upper arm reaching out, a forearm reaching out, and an open hand. It is the Zeruah coming to lift up the two people that are standing, the two Hays in Yahweh's name. The two repeated letters are drawn, depicted by two people standing, reaching up, looking up, observing who God is and what he is offering. They are separated by what is called a tent peg. It is used to describe, this is the wa in Yahweh's name, to describe the implement that is used to enlarge and secure a home. It is the Hebrew word wa, which means and, to increase, to bring together. But you know, when you look at it, it also looks like an image of standing grain. Anyway, those depicted by these letters are reaching up to grasp Yahweh's strong hand, his Zeruah. His name depicts what he's going to do. Now, speaking of the Zeruah, the sacrificial lamb, this is Yahusha. It is the promised seed of Abraham. The Zeruah is the arm of God, the aspect of Yahweh's nature whose shoulders are burdens. It is by this means that Yah enables his covenant promises. It is by this means that the first four Mikrei have been honored, have been fulfilled, so as to empower and to deliver on Yahweh's covenant promises. It is how God, remaining consistent, is going to honor and fulfill the promises associated with Teruah. And then 7 years later, perhaps a little more, on Yom Kippurim, it's how he is going to honor the promise of reconciliation, so that he, 5 days after that, can camp out with us on Sukkah. The nature of this Zeruah, of this arm of God, of this aspect of Yahweh's nature who shoulders our burdens, and as the means to enable the covenant promises, is presented in great detail in a chapter of Yadayah, actually called Zeruah, for those who may be interested. I believe that the Zeruah is presented in the Salvation volume of Yadayah, which focuses fairly intently on other predictions, many of them messianic as it relates to Yosha. Welcome back to Shatteringness. As we mentioned, the term Lakot speaks of a gleaning. And a gleaning is not a term that we use regularly in English. And so it probably should be expanded, amplified, if you will, to describe a smaller secondary harvest. And therefore, it depicts the fulfillment of the Mikra, this invitation to meet with God, of Teruah, which is the time that the covenant's children share Yah's guidance with the world. That it should be placed in its correct position as being the second of two harvests of saved souls. By calling it a gleaning, God is affirming that the harvest will be small. This is consistent with his written proclamation that is found on the first of the two tablets, when he wrote that thousands would receive his mercy by observing his covenant's conditions. Thousands amongst billions is just one in a million. There is evidence later in this prophecy that the total number of souls actually harvested this time will be 7,000. There are 7 billion people on the planet today. That is indeed one in a thousand. Or excuse me, one in a million. In this context, the Raphaim is an extraordinarily telling soul. You know, it speaks of a valley of death, of souls of the deceased. God is saying that those who are left are the walking dead. They are somewhere between alive and dying, but without hope. They're going to die. But the term also reveals that the defects which are afflicting them could have been healed had they made themselves available to the physician, capital P in physician. But because they rejected Yahweh's offer of restoration, their health remains impaired. So it even ties into David's famous psalm, you know, where he talks about walking through the valley of the shadow of death. Well, when the real valley of death descends upon this planet, when a regional war in the Middle East between brought on by all Muslim nations against Israel expands into a global war, and the earth becomes this place of great death, God's covenant children will be gone. Now, recognizing that this prophecy is about to reveal that hell is going to break loose, the testimony regarding the timing of the Teruah harvest provides yet another affirmation that the basis of most everything Yahusha said can be found in the Torah and prophets, making what little is reliable in the Greek texts of the so-called Christian New Testament redundant. In the midst of his opening letter in Revelation, during his presentation of the Philadelphian era, Yahshua revealed that those who love Yahweh's word and Yahweh's name will be kept out of the tribulation. While the Laodicean Christians, living in the affluence that is provided by Western democracies, will be left to endure it. They will remain outside of Passover's doorway, unaware that it is the way to Yahweh's home. So when in the sixth of seven open letters written to the called out in Revelation, when Yahusha said that those who love his name and love his word will be kept out, and he used ek out of the tribulation, he was simply citing what had already been revealed some 750 years earlier through Yahweh, by Yahweh, through Yahshua. And that he then goes on to say that the Christian population of the last days, these Laodiceans, they're going to remain outcasts, left behind, on the wrong side of Passover's door. And so it's just another place that affirms that if we wish to know who Yahusha is, what Yahusha said, we should read the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms, because it's all depicted for us in those words. We'll return to Shatter Emes after the news and commercial break.